This is the Kevin Simpson Show. Expert insight and analysis from the industry's top investment professionals. If you'd like a deeper understanding of today's markets, this is the show for you.
This show is sponsored by Capital Wealth Planning, providing covered call solutions for financial advisors. To learn more about their SMAs or ETF, visit capitalwealthplanning.com.
Welcome to this edition of the Kevin Simpson Show. We're very lucky today to have Bert White from LPL. Bert has a long title, so be patient with me. If I take a couple of takes, I apologize in advance. He's a managing director, investor and investment solutions, and chief investment officer, which I think is the coolest title of the three. We go way back, and back in the days prior to Wells Fargo. I think it was after Wheat First, Butcher, Singer, kind of like a first union, Wheat First Union, Wachovia days. You were known as the wizard back then, Bert. So thank you for bringing your magic to the show.
Hey, thanks. And I appreciate you reading my bio exactly the way I wrote it. The wizard, that's exactly what I call myself all the time, especially to the kids. They love to call me the wizard.
You used to have an answering machine voice message that was also not as politically correct as we have today, but very memorable.
It's probably right.
So, we've both spent our entire careers trying to help the financial advisor. I mean, it's a tremendously noble cause. It's a wonderful, wonderful profession. But I'm wondering, with the landscape changing and everything that's gone on, what are financial advisors not paying attention to these days that you think they should be? Because we all know what we're paying attention to, but I think the uniqueness of your perspective is, what are we not looking at from the financial advisor perspective that we should be?
Well, I think that advisors have been spending so much time focusing on their clients, which they should be in this period of time. We've been through 18 months of craziness for so many of their clients, and they've been focused on that. And I think the one thing that they need to begin to circle back to is their business. Sometimes we forget that, these are financial advisors that have extremely important and noble jobs to help guide clients to their goals and dreams and be able to manage their portfolios and all the stuff that they do. But they also run small businesses, right? And I think that side, as a small business owner, is one that I think for some advisors, that's taken a bit of a back seat here through this pandemic. And I think as the economy begins to restart, as will their businesses begin to restart. And I think making sure that they continue to focus on that aspect, right? The business side of their business is going to end up to be one, I think, that has probably maybe been shortchanged here the last 18 months for good reasons, because they focus on the right things, and that is their clients.
Let's start with something that I've seen you talking about in your Twitter feed here recently, and that's the employment outlook. What's your take, and what do advisors need to be considering today?
Yeah. Just think about this for a second. Who would have thought that, a May's number of like 559,000 jobs would get everybody completely freaked out about how terrible that is, right? It's like, I never thought I'd live in that world. But the reality is, for many people, I think they think that employment is lagging the economic recovery. And I can make the case, I don't think that's true. If you go back to the last 10 or 12 recessions, the average recession takes 30 months to fully recover. So it takes 30 months for jobs to fully recover. A big recession, like the Great Recession, that took 6 years. So the fact that we're about 70% of the way of this sort of labor recovery through 15 to 18 months is actually, I would say, we're on or ahead of schedule. But saying all that, I actually think that labor and frankly, labor shortages are probably going to be the theme of the 2020s. I think labor is the theme. I think what you're starting to see is the emergence of labor as a key driver to corporate America, to the global economy. And so much has changed for the working class American, and the power is shifting, right? This power is shifting from businesses dictating the terms for workers to workers starting to define how they want to work, where they want to work, and with whom they want to take their talents to, right? And so I would just highlight maybe three things. Number one is, the aging of America means that we have fewer and fewer working age adults. If you look at the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s, we had 19 million new working aged adults per decade. Now it's about 6 million, right? So that's slowing. Add on top of that, the participation rate for the labor market that was close to 70% 10 years ago or so is now, you know, six in the 61s, right? And was 63 before the pandemic. The second thing is don't forget about the wealth effect, right? I mean, if you want to see how the wealth effect is pulling through, just go and look at the participation rate of kids that are 16 to 19 years old. I had to work when I was 16 to 19 years old. Right now, you've got a participation rate that is like in the 20s, right? Like who's actually dipping ice cream and working at amusement parks or delivering newspapers? I don't know who it is, right? But like those kids aren't working right now. But that wealth effect of boomers is pulling through. My third one that I would just say is that the fertility rate in the United States has been declining for decades and decades and decades and decades. You know, so smaller families 30 years ago means fewer workers today, right? And what we know is for 40 years in a row, the fertility rate has been under the labor force replacement rate, which is about 2.2 kids per adult woman. So I just think that labor and employment is going to be such a huge factor going forward. And I can see lots and lots and lots of factors and how it pulls through, not only for the economy, but for corporate America.
Kevin, do you have any thoughts on the employment situation and what advisors should be considering as we head into the second half of the year?
I mean, I, first of all, I could sit there and listen to Bert talk about this stuff all day. I learn something every time he opens his mouth. And I completely agree from the standpoint that this is an amazingly rapid recovery. I mean, markets are up over 100% since the pandemic. The fact that we're recovering this quickly as opposed to taking 15 months or 6 years to get the labor force back on track. The real issue is, to Bert's point, we don't have enough people to fill the jobs. It's not a lack of jobs. So unemployment, we saw that go down in the last print. That's a good sign. Inflation is the topic we'll probably get into next, that you kind of sort of think about a little bit in here. But we're reopening from a global shutdown and a pandemic. And I am incredibly enthusiastic about the second half of 2021 from a labor standpoint, a consumer standpoint more than anything. And that can carry through and well, certainly through back to school and into hot holiday shopping season and into 2022.
Yeah, that's a great segue. Let's talk about inflation. Every advisor is having to field questions about inflation. Bert, Kevin had Jeff Sout on the show a couple months ago. Here is his response to the inflation question, and I want to get your take.
We decided that as long as the employment situation is a little sketchy, that we don't need to worry about inflation. And if we don't need to worry about inflation, we don't need to worry about interest rates going up dramatically.
What are your thoughts on Jeff's comments? And then your take on how advisors should be looking at inflation when they build portfolios.
Well, first of all, you both have much better backgrounds today than you did in that clip. Okay, so that's the first thing. Let's just call that out. You've upgraded your backgrounds. Secondly, look, I don't disagree with that. Look, it's impossible to get away from the I word. You know, if you go to Google Trends, I love to go to Google Trends, put in the word inflation. That goes back to 2004. Never, ever has actually folks searched the word inflation more since 2004 than they are today. So the reality is, it is for real. It's on people's minds. You know, here's how I would think about it. You know, I think there's two types of smoke that come from the economy's car. One type of smoke is when you squeal the tires and you smoke those tires as you re-enter a recovery. That's one type of smoke. The other type of smoke is when you overheat the economic engine. So the question is, are we getting the type of smoke that's overheating the engine, or are we getting the type where we are squealing the tires to get onto the recovery highway? I think it's the latter, right? So I think that we are seeing that sort of squealing of those tires. You know, why is it higher? You know, look, we know a lot of it. We know the recovery, but a lot of people don't factor in some of the other reasons. You know, record stimulus, you know, major supply disruptions, a tight labor market we just talked about, but also a lot of people miss it. A year ago, we were a negative CPI. So therefore, the year-over-year comparisons may even look worse than it really should be. So the reality is there's component pieces here that people miss. The one thing I will say, however, is that I think there are big picture things that have been in place that have kept inflation low that will continue to be disinflationary. Technology innovations, globalization, the Amazon effect and all of it, stuff that it brings, productivity, efficiency, automation, AI, machine learning, you know, the high debt we carry, which is going to put downward pressure on inflation. All of those things are still in place, will continue to be in place, and those things are going to help make sure that inflation doesn't get out of control. And so I think that's the big piece that I have. The last thing I just say is, you know, people always are asked, like, well, how do I, what do I do with my portfolio on inflation? And what I usually say is, well, you need to own inflation. And a lot of the way you own inflation is with, you know, asset prices, you know, and that might be done with economically sensitive names, you know, commodities, could be real estate, could be cyclicals. You know, we think that materials and industrials seem to be poised to, you know, benefit nicely in this recovery-led inflationary boost that we'll probably see. And I think financials could do okay, because we, the one thing I would disagree with from Jeff is that we think that interest rates are going to begin to move a little bit further up. We think there's more room for that to move higher. And we think that even though inflation is going to probably be a bit modest going forward, we still think that there's some upward room for interest rates. And we think that might help financials. The last thing I would just say really quickly, because I listened to the segment that Jeff said, and maybe another segment, someone talked about owning branded franchise, which I agree 100%. You own blue chip names, large cap names, branded franchises. These companies have pricing power. And that's the other piece that you want to start to make sure you invest in, is companies that have the pricing power. Many of the small cap names are further down the supply spectrum. They don't have pricing power. They're being told what those prices are. You know, larger branded franchises have that ability.
Excellent. Kevin, what are your thoughts on inflation today, and specifically through the lens of how advisors should be looking at it?
Well, I mean, the squelching of the tire analogy is spot on. I mean, I'd be scared and nervous if there wasn't a hyper, you know, let me take that word back, but I'd be scared and nervous if there wasn't higher inflation right now as we reboost this and restart this economy. So I think it's a good thing. I think it's a positive thing. I don't think we're heading into the 70s for hyperinflation. I saw some, you know, some pretty well-known people this week talking on television about the inflation trade. But to Bert's point, you have a well-diversified portfolio. You own big names. You're going to have it. You know, we own Chevron. I've been driving all over this country, up and down the East Coast, and gas prices are going higher and noticeably higher. I think they're up 40% this year alone. So we're benefiting from that because they can set the price. I'm not going to stop driving halfway to, you know, New Jersey because gas prices are too high. We own Walmart. You know, they're going to be able to set their prices. We just got back into Home Depot recently. They can charge whatever they want for lumber and we're going to pay it. So I love Bert's point. And I feel like if you own high quality blue chip portfolios, you're going to have that exposure. And I also agree that the financials make a heck of a lot of sense here, because one other point with the financials is they haven't been able to raise their dividends since the pandemic started. They're sitting on a lot of money. Don't feel bad for them. If interest rates are low, they still make the full spread, but they're not hurting for money. And a higher interest rate environment, even if it's a modestly higher interest rate environment, is going to help financials. And they're all going to increase their dividends. So I think that you know, there's lots and lots of opportunities out here. And even though prices are high, stock prices are high, great companies that make new highs can go higher. It doesn't mean that you have to abandon the stock market just because we've seen a big run. Own high quality, invest for the long term, and inflation shouldn't be a major problem over the short term.
So let's stay in the area of sectors. Bert, your team's been putting out some work on the tech sector. You guys have some pretty strong opinions that are a little contrary to what we see in the marketplace today. What's your outlook on the tech sector?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's tough to not like technology, right? I think you enter in and you know, I think everyone just automatically puts a permanent tattooed checkmark overweight tech for the rest of your life. And you can make a strong case for that, given, you know, the fundamentals continue to be very strong for tech, and the rapid pace of innovation continues to be very strong for tech. But, you know, our view is that we expect cyclical value sectors like financials, like industrials, like materials, just to fare better for the rest of the year as this economy, you know, continues to get its reopening lightning bolt. And so we've actually downgraded technology to neutral. Now, let's think about what that means. That means downgrading it to 27% of your portfolio. Okay, so that's what neutral means, right? So this is not like, let's take technology and take it to zero, right? It's still like a third of your portfolio, okay? So that's what neutral means for us. You know, we just think that there's a lot of reasons why we think some of the value names might do a little better. We talked about some of them. Why we downgraded tech, I would add a couple of other things to it. Number one is, you know, the reopening favors cyclical. We talked about that. Number two is valuations. I mean, at the end of the day, It's not, you know, tech isn't cheap. You know, if you look on an absolute or relative basis, both of them are relatively high. I think the one that we look at the most is if you compare just overall value to growth based on just sort of the Russell 1000 style indices, it's a big gap. In fact, the growth index is trading at more than a 60% premium to the value index. That's the most in 20 years. And so when you say phrases like that's the most in 20 years, then typically you get to think about, well, I should probably think about how I invest given that, right? So at the end of the day, the last thing I just say on tech is that we're starting to also see its momentum, relative momentum, for those who follow technicals, you know, change a little bit, right? You know, the sector is still near all-time highs. It's still about 80 to 90% of its names are above its 200-day moving average. But that trend line has leveled out, if not even back down a bit, to underperforming the market here lately. Therefore, we think technicals doesn't support it, valuations don't support it, and while fundamentals still look good, we just like other places like cyclical value.
Excellent. It's funny. You start talking about tech not being the ideal place today on some of these social media platforms, and it's like you're committing heresy in this industry. Kevin, what's your team's take on tech today?
I mean, I agree with everything Bert said. I mean, depending upon how you've categorized Visa, you know, we either have 10% in tech or 15%. I mean, we're even lower than a 27% allocation. And how funny is it that like 27% is a neutral weighting? We'll never have more than 25% in any one sector. But at the same time, you know, you're looking at valuations, and yes, they've done incredibly well, and it's awesome. But thinking of Jeff and borrowing a phrase that his father would tell him growing up, you know, good things happen to cheap stocks. When you look at the valuations and you listen to everything Bert just said, you know, why not observe the markets, look at the lay of the landscape, be a little bit early, take some profits on things you've made a fortune with, and buy some cheap stocks, and good things will happen.
Excellent. Sticking with sectors for our next question, Bert, what sector either has your attention because you're positive on it or has you concerned and people aren't paying attention to it other than tech?
Yeah, I might go out in left field on this one, if that's okay. I think real estate's a really interesting sector to watch. I know it's not a big one, but it's a really interesting one to watch. You know, it's leading the S&P for really the last month. It's doubled the S&P year to date. The economy's strong reopening, lower timber prices, improving supply chain disruptions. That's kind of eliminating itself. You got sort of the interest rate stability has been a little bit more stable here lately, and all that's kind of increased its bullishness. And add on top of that, supply is so tight, 1.2 million in supply is a lot less than the 1.6 million in demand. But that's not the main reason why I pay attention to it. Right? The reason I pay attention to real estate is, you know, not necessarily because it's a great investment. Might be. What I really pay attention for is because it's a canary in a coal mine, right? There is no greater measure of confidence than real estate. None. It is your biggest purchase. It's the biggest sort of shot in the arm on your feeling of around your employment situation. But here's the one that people miss. It's also one of the biggest facilitators of future growth. Because when you sign your name to a mortgage, what you're also agreeing to buy is all the stuff to run your house and to fill your house. That's couches and that's lawnmowers and it's bird feeders and it's all that stuff too, right? And it employs a lot of high-paying jobs, electricians and plumbers, and don't forget the manufacturers that make those lawnmowers and bird feeders, right? And so at the end of the day, it's a big facilitator of growth. So one of the things I love to watch is real estate sector. I think it's not a bad sector to think about investing in here, economically sensitive. But on the other side, I think it's really interesting to think about what it means for our economy, which is the main reason why it's got my attention.
Kevin, any particular sector have your attention in a positive or negative way right now?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's all about the consumer. And when you think about home ownership and all the things that come along with it, you know, we had sold Home Depot recently. We had the stock called away. Well, maybe not that recently at this point because we're re-entering the position, which is great. We had Caterpillar called away. We're in the position of hopefully getting back into that. Looking at these stocks that have taken these great accelerations, And we're re-entering them on pullback. But as Bert's talking, I'm just thinking like cha-ching, 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 Home Depot, Walmart. I mean, come on, give it to me. And if Caterpillar pulls back down, we'll be back in there. So I love the concept. I love the employment that it brings to the table from the standpoint of the plumbers, the electricians. And at the same time, it just means that that homeowner, that mortgagee, is going to continue to be a part of the workforce to pay for all the things that homeownership brings to it. So it's full circle, and it's incredibly exciting.
Another hot topic that advisors are struggling with is Bitcoin. And recently we had Christian Magoon, the CEO of Amplify ETFs, on the Kevin Simpson Show, and we asked him about the possibility of a Bitcoin ETF. Bert, I want to play you his response.
Well, it's a real good question. You know, if you talked to me earlier in the year with Gary Gensler being the new head of the SEC, I mean, somebody who has a background in teaching a course on Bitcoin, I would have said probably good chance in 2021 we'll see a Bitcoin ETF. But a lot of the SEC testimony and comments lately seems to point to 2021 not being the year for a Bitcoin ETF.
What are your thoughts on a Bitcoin ETF and then how advisors should talk about it if they are licensed as such?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll tell you, crypto in general is coming up quite often, not only because it's, you know, a hot talk, but also because of its performance. Listen, I don't know if I would consider it an investable asset class quite yet. That said, I think it certainly is a speculative one. And I think it will be at some point. I think that it will be. And so because of that, I do think we're going to start to see more more traditional ways to invest in the product outside of the way it is today. I'd be very, very surprised if we don't see sort of ETFs and probably in droves happen over the next couple of years that come through. And I wouldn't be surprised if it becomes a relatively commonplace 5 to 10 years to think about crypto as a part of a client's portfolio. Right now, I think that it's a tad expensive to me. I'm not a big believer. I'm not a big studier of it, so I'm probably the last person to sort of ask about my opinions on crypto. But at the end of the day, I see the case for it as an investment, and certainly think that it will end up in client portfolios down the road. At some point. But today, I just think there's much better, safer alternatives to think about speculative investing that I'd rather put my money in or my client's money in.
Speaking of historically safe alternatives, this brings me to the last question. And the reason it's the last question is it's the most important for advisors today. Fixed income has been such a great ballast in a portfolio for a generation and a half. You know, our question to you is, how should advisors be looking at fixed income today in 2021 when they're building portfolios?
Bonds are boring. I just refuse to talk about them. So the next question. I'm just kidding. It has been a tough start to bonds this year, right? One of the worst starts to a year for bonds in any year, frankly. I'm not so sure if it's going to get much better from here. I think, you know, long-term interest rates, it's traded sideways here recently, but we expect rates to move marginally higher a little bit, which is going to put continued downward pressure on bond prices. One of the things that we look a lot at is the ratio of copper to gold. It has been a great predictor of 10-year treasury rates, yields, and it's almost the same chart. And what you see is that, you know, copper's rally relative to gold here recently. And really, while the 10 years moved a little bit, it certainly hasn't kept up with that, which tells us, it's not perfect predictor, that really this copper to gold ratio, it's been pretty reliable. And we think that suggests higher interest rates around the corner. We think that that's probably going to happen. So the reality is, here's my real kind of answer to bonds. I think people have completely thought of asset allocation completely backwards and wrong. Okay, so this is the part where you might sort of, you know, hit the pause button on the podcast and wonder if this guy's lost his mind. But hear me out. I think what people have historically done is they've built asset allocation models around asset classes. And when you do that, you're left with the answer of, well, how much should I have in fixed income? And should I have more in fixed income? Should I have less in fixed income? What's my view on fixed income? I think that's the wrong way to build asset allocation models. I think you should build asset allocation models around outcomes. You need to have a portion of your portfolio around protection, a part of your portfolio around appreciation, a part of your portfolio around inflation hedge, a part of your portfolio around income. And we're going to be different in how we need those outcomes. And so when I think about bonds right now, I certainly wouldn't put them in my appreciation camp because rates are likely to go flat or up. I'm certainly not going to put them in the income part because they ain't going to yield anything. What they will do, however, is help you with protection. We've seen when the market is down more than 3% in a given month, that you've seen treasuries do extremely well. And so I would continue to have bonds in that one part of my outcome, part of my asset allocation. But what I wouldn't think about doing is put them in other places. And I think there are much better opportunities in how you think about appreciation or how you think about protection or even how you think about income. I would just restrict them to those areas that you need for protection in your portfolios to ballast the rest of your models.
Kevin, what are your thoughts around how advisors should be looking at fixed income today?
My thoughts are how lucky are the LPL financial advisors that they get access to BERT every day. I mean, what a brilliant way of looking at things. And, you know, the Fed's coming out now and they're talking about acknowledging some inflation, still keeping interest rates low, and they're trying to, keep any future rate hikes to 2023. But as we've learned, you know, the markets have a mind of their own sometimes. And having this as a protective concept in the hedge portion of your portfolio is a validation that makes perfect sense. Probably thinking of 60-40 in the old way of looking at it, you know, it's easy to do that when you've got 32 years of decreasing interest rates, but you can throw the historical nonsense out the window because past performance in this case really isn't any indication of future returns. So keeping fixed income is a reality, but looking at alternative sources, and Bert mentioned real estate is a great way to generate income. We look at dividends, rising dividends, covered calls as a means of helping to accentuate cash flow. But our future for fixed income for the foreseeable future is one that, you know, we probably wouldn't be overly bullish on.
Excellent. Bert, we appreciate you coming on the show. Financial advisors, learn more about LPL and the resources they provide advisors by visiting LPL.com. And as always, learn more about Capital Wealth Planning by visiting CapitalWealthPlanning.com.
Thanks, Wizard.
Thank you, my friend. Good to see you guys.
Thanks, Bert. Thanks, Jay. See you next week.
This message does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to purchase securities through CWP Advisory Services. Investments are not guaranteed and involves risk of loss. The views and opinions expressed in this message are those of investment professionals made at the time this content was recorded, are not necessarily the views and opinions of CWP, and may change in time without notification. For additional information about CWP, visit CWP's or the SEC's website for a copy of our ADV disclosure brochure and Form CRS.